Herbert Randall is a noted photographer, most renowned for his photographic work during the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s. He's the featured speaker on our program today.
What I want to talk to you about today is about the issue of remembering, commemorating the civil rights movement, both through formal means, like monuments and memorials, some very elaborate, some very simple, like this one to Goodman, Turner, and Cheney at Mount Zion in Philadelphia, where we'll be going on Sunday. But I also want to talk to you about, I'm going to close this down a little, talk to you about the experience of spaces and settings as in which key events took place, as another way of memorializing or commemorating the movement, and to talk to you about the my title, which the subtitle is "What Can and Can't Be Said." By that I mean several things. I mean what's possible, what can and can't be expressed by these kinds of means about that history. What aspects of that very very complex history can be expressed by monuments, by memorials, by this kinds of commemoration. What are the limits of our imagination? There's a tradition of commemoration and memorialization in Western culture, largely, that these monuments come out of, that allows one to say certain kinds of things and isn't very good for saying other kinds of things. And finally, and perhaps most important, what's permitted to be said in public about a still volatile area, and what kinds of things are not permitted to be said, and implied by that, implied as well, my own point of view, what I am able to see and not to see, is part of this question as well, because I'm the product of first of all of this era, the civil rights era. The era in which the civil rights movement was at its peak, but I was also someone who was too young to have taken part in any of the events of that era. But yet, I feel very strongly that my fundamental moral sense was formed by the images that I saw on television, and by the images that I saw in primarily in Life magazine, which my parents subscribed to. The earliest reports, the earliest televised reports that I can remember are those that show the integration of Central High School in Little Rock in the fall of 1957. I remember seeing this on afternoon television. But very oddly, what I remember about this, the images that stuck in my mind then were not the images of the nine black students or their tormentors, but the images of the National Guard that President Eisenhower had so reluctantly ordered to come to the school and keep order after several days of very violent resistance on the part of white citizens of Little Rock. It was that presence of army troops in an American city, I think, still then conveyed a kind of gravity or moral authority that it no longer can convey and probably will never be able to again given what's happened in recent years. My father was from Arkansas. He grew up in the Arkansas mountains. He was an honest-to-God hillbilly, although he wouldn't have liked me saying that. For him, hillbillies were only people he didn't like. But I in fact was raised in upstate New York, and these images of 1957 and the years that followed it were really burned into my mind as I was growing up. But also for me, equally important was the landscape, the setting in which these things took place. They became inseparable parts of the events, and perhaps they have something to do with why landscape and the built environment, the human, what geographers call the cultural environment, is so important to me. When I first moved to the South in the 1970s, I moved to Virginia. The thing that surprised me was how invisible these landscapes were that I remembered from those news reports and TV images. In later years, I had the opportunity to travel more in the South, and particularly deeper into the South, and I sought out more of the sites of those famous incidents of the civil rights movement. This is the Woolworths in Greensboro, North Carolina, where the first sit-ins occurred there. But again, as I traveled around, it seemed to me that something was missing. The kind of perverse enchantment that those scenes and the kind of the often violent events of the 1950s and 60s, they gave these scenes a kind of perverse enchantment, and that seemed to have evaporated by the time I got there in the 1970s. The everyday landscape of streets and churches and houses and stores that hosted the scenes that I witnessed seemed to have vanished. In some cases, that was literally true. The 1970s was the time when urban renewal came to the South with a vengeance. It had wrecked the cities of the North in the 50s and 60s and then turned south like a hurricane in the 1970s. But even where the pre-1950 landscape did survive, something seemed to be missing, and that was and continues to be a source of great thought to me, that kind of mythical, foreboding, seductive landscape of the Deep South that one saw in the backgrounds of the famous photographs of the civil rights movement turned out to be very ordinary and banal, even boring. It was hard to realize, to recover the kind of reactions that I had to those places in hearing and seeing them on television and in photographs, to feel that when I was actually there. And yet, it's something that I continue to visit. I will continue to visit these sites, and I'm not alone. As you know, so-called civil rights tourism and African American history tourism is a growing industry in the South. And states put out, we got in our packet, several guidebooks to civil rights sites in Jackson and in Mississippi. There, southern states are putting these out in great numbers. In reaction, you get many local people who, in the words of a recent New York Times report about Philadelphia, dread the prospect of becoming an official site on the growing civil rights tourism circuit. So clearly, I'm not the only person who feels some attraction to see the places where things happen as well. So the first layer of this issue, this question of what can and can't be said that I'm asking about, has to do with what can and can't be said by the landscape itself. What is it possible to find there? What can we get out of going to the places where things happen? To what extent are these sites of these key events records or repositories or in themselves commemorations of the meanings of the things that had happened there? And what I mean to convey by my personal story to illustrate is the way that events and meanings from the most routine everyday meetings of our lives to the most extraordinary ones are tied to particular settings, and they become inseparable from them. This is the, we've gone, I think, too far. That sites of significant events, they have significance. They become the settings for ordinary or extraordinary events that are acted out in specific times. The particularity of these sites, this is the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, the site of the famous confrontation in 1965. What happens there makes the sites important, and at the same time, the things that happen there are in a way authenticated by their sites, by the facts that they occur at a particular place, a place that's very mundane, a place that has that is in its own way different from other places, but in some ways not different from other places, so that people and places, actions and sites mutually together make the meaning of a place. That if you take one or the other away, then you lose much of that meaning. The site absent the people loses much of its meaning, but also the people, if we think of the people floating in space away from a particular site, then we lose some of the meaning of an event as well. But when saying that, what that means in particularly, specifically, we need to think about a little more explicitly. And particularly, we need to think about the difference between, or acknowledge the difference between, the experience of someone like me when I was a child, a remote viewer, someone watching things on television, seeing things in pictures, where sight and action get fused into a kind of closely edited tableau, a two-dimensional tableau on the one hand, and on the other hand, the experience of participants, people who are in this site, in the three-dimensional, on the scene with all the kind of messiness of a three-dimensional space. Those things will be different, and they'll convey different things. When I was this young person living in upstate New York watching these things on TV, what I was watching was very much a moral drama. Some of that moral drama frighteningly improvised. Some of the violence that took place and the attacks on the sit-ins in Jackson, the burning of the buses of the Freedom Riders, and others of these moral dramas very carefully staged, where all the participants knew what they were doing, played them out, as people have argued for Birmingham, played them out in a way that was timed to make the news in the North each day. The sit-ins in Jackson and the demonstrations in Birmingham took place at exactly the same time. So I, as a person watching them on TV in the North, could see both of these things, where the participants in these events could only see one of them. That simultaneity, not available to an actual participant, but available to someone watching. The stage sets, the Pettus Bridge, the rundown Woolworths in Greensboro or Jackson, the Kelly Ingram Park in Birmingham with this shabby commercial building surrounding it. All these things become inseparable from the actions that take place there. For example, if you look at this photograph, or think about how many photographs in Birmingham do you see in the background the sign for the Jockey Boy restaurant? If you think about what the demonstrations were about, and you think about Jockey Boys, we saw one yesterday, and their kind of place in the racist iconography of American popular culture, it becomes a kind of Greek chorus back there commenting on what's happening in the picture. But also, when we see pictures like this, and we see them in these very specific sites, the particularity of the site, the fact that these elements are always there, I think, enable the viewer to empathize, to imagine being in that place at that time, being sprayed by those fire hoses, or I suppose if you were of a particular point of view, being the one spraying people by those fire hoses. The ordinariness of it makes it a kind of witness to the truth of the events. It's a tradition that goes back in Western culture to early Christianity, and the idea of the martyria, the idea of collecting relics and marking the physical sites of crucial events in the religion. The physicality of them, the premise is, testifies to the truth of the stories that you tell about them. See, this person really lived. Here's his finger bone. This thing really happened. Here's where it happened. When we visit Birmingham, though, now we see that the Jockey Boy restaurant and those buildings no longer exist. Most of the settings in the famous photographs, particularly the famous urban photographs of the civil rights movement, no longer exist. They were destroyed by urban renewal, and in doing that, the events themselves tend to lose some of their presence or some of their reality. And in fact, I think that this is the point of much of the urban renewal in the South of the 1970s, is to remove that record. In cities where you had, in southern cities and towns, and in fact many northern cities and towns, you had separate, for example, black and white business districts. What happens when urban renewal comes along? You eradicate the black business district, and you get the appearance of a landscape. You erase that duality in the landscape. I always tell people that the way to find the black Main Street in any southern city is to look for federal buildings and parking lots. And that's literally true. And the some of the formal commemoration of the civil rights movement since the 1990s, for reasons that, I'll show you, that I'll mention in a minute, also, it seems to me, are created in part to eradicate that physical record and to rewrite the story. So that's the significance for someone like me who is watching this on TV. If you were a participant in the events, even where they were staged, it seems to me that the landscape that they occurred in had a very different significance. Historians and anthropologists in recent years have come to stress the way that the bonds of memory and identity are carried in the body. That is, they're carried, they are acted out in the process of our moving through familiar spaces of everyday life. Our physical settings channel us in certain ways. They cue us to act in certain ways, to be certain people or not to be certain people, to be or not to be certain kinds of people. And the most ordinary sites of our lives, the most frequently encountered sites of our lives, the spaces of everyday life are the most important in this way, because doing the same things day after day, same place over and over and over again, drill these roles into us, using a military metaphor. What happens in when you learn to march, or you learn to play the piano, or you learn to play a sport, you do that physical action over and over and over until that's you and you don't even think about it anymore. And that's something of the effect the landscape has on our identities. We get to the point where it cues us to act in certain ways without even thinking about it. That becomes us. It becomes part of our self-presentation, our posture, whether we stand up straight or whether we hunch, whether we look people in the eyes or whether we don't, whether we encounter people directly or whether we walk around them to avoid them. So for the people in these, people who are taking place in the things going on in these photographs, the Jockey Boy restaurant, the other kinds of mundane settings around Kelly Ingram Park, were the everyday spaces of segregated society. They were the spaces in which the assigned roles of black and white Alabamians, Southerners, assigned social roles were drilled into them. Carrying out actions such as you see in these photographs break those molds. It's very significant that these actions take place in Kelly Ingram Park, which is on the boundary between black and white Birmingham, which is surrounded by black churches, but which is legally a white park, closed to blacks. So what these demonstrators are doing is redefining the boundaries, redefining that landscape by crossing lines. They're inhabiting it differently. They're rejecting the cues that are built into the landscape and living in it different ways. And it's these kinds of acts of defiance are significant in themselves, but they're also significant in that they are a kind of dramatic presentation of that commemorate and extend other longer standing, less visible kinds of refusal in everyday life. For example, in Birmingham, for a long time before the demonstrations of the 60s, many African American, often working class African Americans, quietly refused to obey the segregation on the buses, the kind of protest that wasn't as visible as what was filmed for national TV, but was the same kind of boundary crossing, the same kind of line crossing, just as the kind of ritualized violence that took place in Kelly Ingram Park with the fire hoses and so on dramatized the very real but equally inconspicuous everyday violence that African Americans in Birmingham extended. So what was going on in Kelly Ingram Park was a play in a sense, but a very serious play. But in both the cases of the demonstrations in the park and the everyday refusals to obey lines, what these people were doing were rejecting the social identities that were assigned to them by rejecting the cues in the landscape, refusing to accede to the routinized bodily memories that these landscapes were supposed to build in, and in doing so, defining new selves. by using space in a new way, saying we are not those people that we are supposed to be, we are these new people. And in the process, because selfhood is always a transactional thing, by defining new selves for themselves, by default, white selves were also redefined. Were transformed in the same way. So actions like the sit-ins, actions like the Children's Crusade in Birmingham, intended on one level as spectacles for outsiders to witness, in that way to make points that were projected by the organizers of the demonstrators. But at the same time, we can't overlook the personal effect that these actions must have had on individuals who participated, because bringing about a kind of personal exhilaration, a personal transformation. Anybody who's ever participated in a big demonstration, I think about being in this enormous demonstration last year in San Francisco and against the war, and you get that being that, doing that, brings a kind of transformation that is hard to describe, and that is very much individual over and above whatever the political goals of the action are. So we need to think of the civil rights movement in this way, as much a personal movement for personal transformation through these kinds of bodily refusals, bodily actions. So what formally is defined, and what's often defined in history books and so on, as a series of legal actions, as movement for voting rights, movement for housing rights, for educational rights, the rights to hold office, civil rights in its narrowest sense. In the larger sense, what the civil rights movement was, in terms of everyday experience, what the French sociologist Henri Lefebvre called a claiming of the right to the city, a claiming of a liberty to move about and act as will. What segregation was, both de facto and de jure segregation, is a kind of spatial sorting, a kind of saying you can't go here, you can't do this, and the spatial setting, the violating of those lines is a very important element to keep in mind. And this is why most of the symbolic actions, the formal actions, the staged actions, but also many of the spontaneous actions, were about movement through space and attempts by authorities to stop people from moving through space, to stop marches, to stop people from going from one place to another. So the question becomes, now that the dramatic confrontations are over, now that the spaces have lost much of their human presence, because what happened there, both in ordinary life and in extraordinary life, is no longer there. This is the Robert R. Moton School in Farmville, Virginia, which was the scene of a demonstration in 1951 over unequal school conditions, led to a lawsuit, and that lawsuit was one of the lawsuits folded into Brown versus Board of Education. But these are over, so the spaces have lost much of that human presence that enlivened them. And remember, I said sight and action together make the space. So the question is, what now? Because the space can no longer represent or say why it's important. It can no longer tell us what distinguishes it from any many similar insignificant, uninteresting, ordinary spaces in the South. And yet we have this rise of tourism. We have the rise of events such as this, which suggest that people want some sort of witness, some sort of remembrance, a remembrance for those who hadn't been present as much or more than for those who were. And the response usually takes some sort of form of some sort of monument. This is the one place at the Moton School, and so that brings us to the second and the third aspects of what can and can't be said, what can be imagined to be said on the one hand, and what is permitted to be said on the other hand. And what can be imagined is circumscribed in many respects, as I mentioned, by the Western monumental tradition. The kinds of people, the kinds of events, the kinds of values that are usually commemorated, the visual language and metaphors that are usually used in those commemorations, all fit in a kind of uneasy way with what the civil rights movement was about. If we think about the kinds of monuments people build, the kinds of monuments we're familiar with, here's the Robert Gould Shaw Monument, the monument that commemorates the officer of the 54th, Massachusetts 54th, the Black Regiment in the Civil War. They tend to use animate beings, people and animals, creatures of various sorts, to represent abstract qualities. Equestrian monuments, putting the leader on a horse, we all recognize in this tradition as saying something about the importance of that person. They also tend to use, in that tradition, images of particularized, sometimes very trivial or ordinary actions, the soldiers marching, for example, Booker T. Washington removing the veil, he's taking the blanket off the head of somebody, but metaphorically he's removing the veil of ignorance from the Black Southern population, and one of the key elements of this is this image. If you look at the 2 feet next to one another, the barefoot versus the shod foot, this tiny detail tells you everything about the message of this monument. This is at Tuskegee, but there's one just like it in front of Booker T. Washington High School in Atlanta. So these things, these trivial actions, these ordinary elements are used, gestures are used to convey the higher meaning of an event or of a person. So the body, again, the body becomes a carrier or representation of a social role. And in each case, some sort of narrative is there. We can tell a little story about what's going on in this monument. And those are all things that in the tradition that we're used to serve to make a monument legible.
The comments of photographer Herbert Randall. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.